This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, yesterday we learned of the death of Sean Fitzpatrick. Sean was one of the most famous men in the country. He was former chief executive and chairman of Anglo-Irish Bank. His life was fascinating. His rise was astonishing, and the crash that came at the end of it was also astonishing and very damaging. Many people believe he was 73 years of age. He died on Monday, and he was a very important figure in this society. And to discuss Sean Fitzpatrick and Anglo-Irish Bank and his story, it's a pleasure to welcome to the stand Simon Carswell. Simon wrote a stunning book called Anglo-Republic. And it was rightly acclaimed. The Sunday Times called it a stunningly well-researched book, and it certainly was that. Simon, thanks for joining us. The news was a surprise, a shock. 73 these days isn't so old. The story is incredible. Your book, Anglo-Republic, had a subtitle, Inside the Bank That Broke Ireland. It was an anti-establishment bank, wasn't it? And he didn't come from the sort of gene pool that usually provides our leading bankers.
He really didn't. He came from a very different background to the kind of to the background that a lot of the bankers that would go into AIB and Bank of Ireland, where they would come from. He started life as a chartered accountant. Now, a lot of bankers start in accountancy, but he started off in a different kind of institution. It was a much smaller bank. He started off in Irish Bank of Commerce in the 1970s, and that was a bank. It only had 4 staff at the time. Now, yes. It would go on and merge with a couple of other banks. It merged with another bank, City of Dublin Bank, and then Anglo-Irish Bank, where the bank would get its name. But it was a tiny, tiny bank when Sean Fitzpatrick started off running it in the mid-80s. It had about a loan book of about €600,000, so about £500,000 at the time. So it was a real minnow in the banking market. But he saw a gap in the market. He saw potential there. He saw in AIB and Bank of Ireland, you know, stuffy banks that would take a long time for to say yes or no to customers on loan approvals. And he saw that this kind of growing class of professional in Ireland, be it doctor, dentist, lawyer, accountant, builder, developer, he saw an opportunity. So like, well, we could be another bank for you. We can give you a quick response on a proposal for a bank loan, for a property or for a business idea. And we can get to know you very well, and we can get you that money quickly if you want. And he really Anglo kind of mirrored the rise of the Irish economy, the economic recovery that took place through the 1990s and into the noughties, and Anglo really capitalized on that because of that position that Sean Fitzpatrick put the bank in. Now, saying that, they would give you a quick yes, but they would want, they'd get their hooks in you. You know, they'd look for a personal guarantee. They'd look for a charge on the property. They'd look for any cash flow coming in the building. They'd want a chunk of that as well. And obviously then the underlying security, the property itself. So they would really, what Sean Fitzpatrick would call like the belt and braces approach. And he'd get you your money quickly, but he'd want his pound of flesh as well to protect the bank. But it seemed to work. The market was going one way at that time. And yes, there were a lot of losses in the early days in the 80s and 90s, but he figured out a lending model that really was going to be very successful as the property market in particular rose to the degree it did.
Yeah, and he was accessible. I met him and encountered him and he was accessible. There was no sense of him being stuffy or in any way remote, the way, say, leading figures in the banking world could regard themselves very highly. He was a kind of, he was a people person, I think he might describe himself as.
Absolutely. He was a gregarious figure. And I think I think people liked working with him, liked doing business with him. And that worked on his side as well. He would get to know the business people very, very well. He'd get to know what money they had, where their assets were, how good they were at business. So that worked both ways. The bank was happy to lend money to these individuals because it got to know these individuals particularly well. And equally, the individuals liked working with Shawnee and his senior bankers. It's phenomenal, actually, when you talk to people in business and how not just they were on first-name basis with bankers, but it was more than that, that they got on very well with them. They admired them. They liked being around them. And they were quite happy to they were quite happy to basically share as much information as they could. Now, saying that, they could be very tough, the Anglo guys, as well.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
They never, like, the fees they charged were not cheap. Like, the percentage fees on loans were higher than the other banks. But the property developers and builders in particular liked Anglo and were happy to pay up to do business with Anglo and to be bankrolled by Anglo because in a market which was booming and which was growing through the 90s and noughties, it was very important to be able to get your money quickly so you could agree deals. And that's why they liked dealing with Anglo. But Sean Fitzpatrick was tough. I mean, he liked a lot of the people he worked with. They liked him. But I mean, I recall one time, particularly with the issue of personal guarantees, that was a way of Anglo to get very tight with their customers. And there was one story I remember being told that there was a bit of a difficulty over a personal guarantee with a customer, and Sean Fitzpatrick said, you know, insisted on this personal guarantee, and his line was, if we get our toes wet, I want you to effing drown. Is basically the point is, we're going to give you this money, but we're going to be protected first.
Yes. Now, two people that a piece you co-authored for today's Irish Times with Joe Brennan, one of them is Paul Coulson, who was in charge of a small company in relative terms, the Irish Glass Bottle Company. He is now the head of a massive multinational group, the Ardagh Group, which is hugely successful. And he told you yesterday that how amenable Sean Fitzpatrick was and indeed his team. And he says Ardagh would never have got off the ground and become the company it is today without Sean Fitzpatrick. And another testimony from Dermot Desmond is rather interesting. Dermot is a huge player, a billionaire. He's the owner of International Investment and Underwriting, a private equity firm. And he said to you of Sean, some of his colleagues were unfairly vilified, while the reputations of their counterparts in other Irish institutions were left untarnished. Dermot goes on to say that Sean was a decent, honourable Irishman who played a major part in Ireland's economic recovery from the dark days of the pre-Celtic Tiger Depression. He described Sean as a beautiful person with a wonderful family. Now, that is common basic decency when somebody has just died suddenly, but it does suggest that he was regarded affectionately, even right up to the present time, by those he did business with.
Yeah, I mean, I think the comments by Coulson and Dermot Desmond kind of point to this rebalancing that people in business feel needs to be done a little bit. And all of the issues that arose with Anglo after the crash need to be balanced by the fact that this is a bank that for a period of time did a lot of good in Irish business, helped a lot of businesses start off. And remember, the model at Anglo was, where you can't get loans at all or quickly from Bank of Ireland and AIB, we can respond quickly and help you out. And what that did was it gave a lot of people in business their start. And if you look at some of the projects they bankrolled, like the Jervis Centre, for example, in Dublin's inner city, that was a project that wouldn't have happened if Anglo hadn't bankrolled it. And that was the mid-90s. And other banks may have been very reluctant to step in on that, but Anglo stood in. So that's a good example of someone like Paddy McKillen starting off, very successful businessman now. That was one of the very big gamble, you could say. Who would have thought a shopping centre in Dublin's north inner city would do as well as it did? But again, Anglo saw the risks, they saw the potential, and they took a punt on it. And I think other banks wouldn't have done that. So when Coulson and Desmond talk about, there's these things that happened in the crash, and yes, we feel Sean Fitzpatrick was a convenient scapegoat, as Coulson said, or unfairly vilified, as Dermot Desmond said, when he's pointing to the fact that other bankers didn't take their share of the blame, that certainly the share of the blame that was landed on Sean Fitzpatrick's shoulders. They're pointing to the fact that, listen, this guy did a lot of good at a particular time, and we need to balance that with what happened.
Yes,
the crash.
It's a normal sort of decency. One of the headlines on your piece this morning, well, the headline is "Poster Boy Turned Whipping Boy of Irish Banking." Now, the poster boy part of it is well known. The whipping boy is also fascinating because there were many people. I mean, there was a regulator, for example, Patrick Neary, who didn't appear to be very effective. There was the central bank, which didn't appear to be very effective. And there were the heads of the Bank of Ireland and AIB. All of those people remained without shame or without any very serious consequence. Where did he go wrong, in your view, Simon? Because the book you wrote, which I can confirm is a brilliant book, was very, very detailed indeed. Where did it all begin to his argument, and he made this argument in a famous interview with Marion Finucane, was Lehman Brothers and the Wall Street crash explained the woes of Anglo-Irish Bank. That wasn't entirely accurate, was it?
No, I think what happened with the collapse of Lehman Brothers and all the pressure that was going on in the international money markets in 2008 was the trigger. But there were our very own kind of homegrown problems, clearly, with Irish banks. And, I think it's a bit of a convenient excuse that certainly was peddled at the time. I don't really hear it said as much, but it was peddled at the time by bankers saying, we'd be grand if Lehman Brothers hadn't happened. But clearly, there was major problems in the loan books, particularly in Anglo, but also just across the other banks as well. The fact that Anglo cost the state $30 billion in the overall banking crisis was in the order of about $60 billion shows that it's not solely a problem that Anglo created.
How did that happen? Did the Irish government at the time, Fianna Fáil government, they tried to save Anglo, is that accurate? And when they should have cut it loose?
Well, the argument at the time was you kind of had two options. And I think it's kind of simplified a bit by saying that, but that was kind of the view at the time, that you could either nationalise Anglo or save the other banks. At that point, in that week at the end of September, Anglo was losing in the order of about $1 billion a day in deposits. So that was an emergency that had to be solved at that time. The view on that kind of fateful night of the bank guarantee was that, if we did nationalize Anglo, we may not stop the run on the other banks. So it needs to be a more systemic solution. That was the view on the night. And that's why they introduced the bank guarantee. Now, what they should have known and didn't know at the time was just the extent of the holes in the banks, the problems, the capital issues, the losses that were coming from all the property loans they gave. They didn't think to that at that moment. It was all about liquidity and getting the money to the banks to keep them standing, keep them going. So where I think Shawnee went wrong was the fact that, you referred to that Marion Finucane interview. I think that was a kind of tone-deaf moment by him.
Yes.
I think he did himself no favours by making the decision to go on radio that day and to say what he said. He said at the time, I can't say sorry with any type of sincerity and decency, but I do say a very genuine thank you. So to go on a radio program two or three days, a week, almost a week after the bank guarantee, and say, you're not going to say sorry for what happened and blame it on the international markets. That's, whether it's accurate or not, it just, it doesn't, it's not a kind of clever PR thing to do. No. And actually, there was another incident at that time that's kind of forgotten, but he actually gave a speech at a business event in a golf club near his home in Greystones on the same day he gave the Marion Finucane interview. And it was kind of astonishing, the comments he made at that. He said that he was talking about the budget that Brian Lennon, his finance minister at the time, was going to have to bring before the Oireachtas. And Fitzpatrick said in that speech that the government should tackle what he called sacred cows. They should abolish the universal state pensions, child benefit, and medical cards for the over 70s. So if you thought that the Marion Finucane interview was tone deaf, he kind of added, he poured petrol on the fire started by that interview with those comments at that event. But I think it just points to the fact that Fitzpatrick just wasn't in the place realizing what he needed to do and what he needed to say and the extent of the problems that people perceived the banks as having landed the country in. And he didn't see that, and he should have. And that made him public enemy number one.
I think, as you've written, it was a classic example of hubris. I want to get to the position he was in when he was chief executive. He vacated that role and became chairman of the bank, and David Drum became the chief executive. Now, there is the matter of loans he took. 100 million he'd taken in loans from Anglo. Is that an accurate figure, Simon?
Yeah, I mean, it varied over the years. I think at peak, it was up to about 129 million Sean Fitzpatrick had borrowed from the bank. And that's actually what caused his resignation in December 2008. He had been moving them on and off the books of the bank just before the day the auditors would come in and take the snapshot of the accounts. So he was hiding them. He was hiding them from shareholders, from investors, from the media. And it went on for a period of several years. And that, when it emerged, was ultimately the reason why he had to stand down as chairman of the bank.
I mean, that was systematic corruption. And it was extremely damaging to people who were shareholders in the bank as well.
Well, it was. And he was charged in relation to that. He was charged with misleading the auditors. Now, that eventually went to two trials. And the second trial collapsed because it was collapsed over a botched investigation by the state's corporate enforcement agency. So he was never convicted over that issue. He escaped any conviction arising from those loans.
Now, Sean Quinn enters this story, does he not? And is a very important figure in this crisis, because whilst long after other people had given up on Anglo and were shorting it, Sean Quinn was buying Anglo shares. And was he getting money from Anglo to buy the shares?
He was. I mean, he was.
Can you explain that story to us? Because it's really fascinating and tells us a lot about Sean Quinn.
Well, like a lot of people in business, Sean Quinn was an admirer of Sean Fitzpatrick and later of David Drum. He liked the kind of anti-establishment approach that Anglo had taken. It's very similar to his own approach in business, Sean Quinn's approach in business, which was anti-establishment. And they really were kind of, their fates were ultimately entwined over what happened with Sean Quinn's interest. He started building a massive investment in Anglo-Irish Bank, but not in straight run-of-the-mill shares. He did it in what they're called contracts for difference, which is kind of like a leveraged bet on a share. The benefit is, there's a few benefits of it. One is that you don't need to put up the full outlay for the share. You can put down like a deposit, so you get the full value, but you're only putting down 20%. If you have CFDs, you don't have to declare them, or you didn't have to declare them to the market at the time. And so you could keep your shareholding and investment anonymous. And that suited Sean Quinn. It didn't suit the bank when it emerged that he'd built up to about 29% of an investment in the bank, which was a huge share and punt, shareholding and punt on the bank. And it was a problem for Anglo, because if Sean Quinn got in trouble, that would result in the share price being destabilized. And at a time when everyone was watching share prices and anything happening with a bank, the public perception around a bank or any kind of question mark over its financial stability, that would lead to a run in deposits in an international financial crisis. So Sean Quinn put Anglo and himself in a very, very precarious position. I think what's fascinating about this story is Anglo didn't realize the extent that Sean Quinn was into the bank until the showdown meeting in September of 2007.
Which I think you cover in your book. I remember reading it I think Sean Fitzpatrick, and they drove off to meet Sean Quinn. I think that met possibly David Drum was with him, but they got an awful shock when they realized that he owned them.
Yeah, I think that when they realized the extent of their shareholding, I think that was probably the moment, if they were looking kind of deep down in their souls, to, if they were to look back, as a moment of crisis for the bank. I mean, there were many in 2008 and thereafter, but that was a moment of crisis in 2007, an issue that they really had to resolve. And that ultimately was what forced the bank against the wall. And, backs against the wall and Anglo, they looked to solve that problem. They looked to see what they could do. And that involved lending vast sums of money as those margin calls came in, with the share price falling. The CFD provider said, you've put down a leverage bet here, the share price has fallen, you need to put up more money to cover your bet. And that's what Sean Quinn had to do. And it was tens of millions initially, up to hundreds of millions. And his losses were in the magnitude of 3 billion. It's an astonishing figure, one of the biggest losses, if not certainly the biggest loss, on a share price in Irish corporate history, perhaps in the world's history. 3 billion is a massive amount of money to lose on one stock.
And of course, that had knock-on effects for Quinn's business and indeed for his future. Just about the establishment, as it might be called, Simon, Patrick Neary, the regulator, and the central bank. Were they remiss? I remember seeing Patrick Neary on primetime, and he assured the audience that night that the Irish banking system was rock solid and had loads of capital. There was no crisis at all. At that point, in reality, we were deeply into the crisis.
Well, I think at that moment, Pat Neary didn't know what he didn't know is probably the difficulty with that. There was a major problems looming in the banks. They were heavily, heavily exposed to the property market. And at the kind of extent of the leverage that property developers and in turn the banks had to those property developers was just unknown at that point. So Pat Neary going on, his focus was on liquidity, but he really didn't know the extent of the holes that were in the banks that were going to emerge over the subsequent years. And at that point, the market had bet against Ireland and Irish banks and the property markets. In our view, they're gone. That was what international investors, that was the view they were taking then. The role of the central bank was much more of a kind of macro level, looking at, central bank governor at the time, John Hurley, said he would have issued those warnings. But I think those warnings were not very good when they were issued and fell on deaf ears. And the fact that there was this kind of fractured relationship between the financial regulator and the central bank, and the fact that we had what was this light touch, hands-off regulator who was kind of described to me once as kind of regulating for grown-ups. It really, you needed a much more forceful regulator to get into the banks and say, well, hang on, how much of your loan book is into these 10 developers or 20 developers? Is that too great a concentration of risk? Are those too many eggs in one basket? And that was the problem with Anglo. It was a problem. It was an over-concentration of risk.
Now, the other banks, Bank of Ireland and AIB in particular, they also, were they sucked in?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
To this by Anglo, and by the perceived success of Anglo, because it was at one stage regarded as one of the most successful banks in the world, wasn't it? It wasn't just acclaimed here. It was being acclaimed everywhere.
It was. It was acclaimed by a financial consultancy at the time of the mid-noughties, saying it is the best bank in the world.
Yes.
And it was certainly one of the most profitable banks in the world, because it was essentially a property lender lending into a market that was property market that was booming. So of course it was going to make hundreds of millions in profits on the back of all those billions of loans that they gave to customers. What AIB and Bank of Ireland saw initially as this upstart, kind of slightly, you know, ridiculing or mocking of this bank attempting to be a big player in the market, that changed radically as they started making money. And you had real nervousness within Bank of Ireland and AIB. Within their boardrooms, there were questions being asked. It's like, what are we doing
yes.
right? What is Anglo doing right? AIB set up a win-back team at one point to try and get customers back that they had lost to Anglo
yeah.
and that were making so much money through their relationship with Anglo. Bank of Ireland, there was even a discussion at one point within the boardroom of the bank that, you know, there was such love out there in the market for Anglo that potentially big investment companies may even help Anglo mount a takeover of Bank of Ireland. And certainly
yes.
Sean Fitzpatrick was named circulated at one point when the role of Bank of Ireland chief executive, that seat became vacant. So all those kind of point to the fact that the banks felt that they had misjudged Anglo and really wanted to win back a lot of the business. Michael Buckley, the chief executive of AIB, famously said, you know, they're stealing our lunch. We need to
yes.
do something about it. And they, ultimately for the Irish taxpayer and the Irish state, they followed Anglo down that route of
yes.
heavy lenders into the construction and property development market. And with that unregulated race, that was going to be a major problem for not just those banks, but the Irish state ultimately.
Yeah, and I want to just ask you a couple of final questions, Simon. One is about the continuing consequences of Anglo and the whole, you could argue it was the end of the Fianna Fáil party as we had known it. You could argue that the debt, the national debt we now have has been hugely contributed to by this hubris of Shawnees. What are the long-term fundamental consequences of that whole exercise, that dramatic rise and crashing fall? The consequences for the country and for the leading political party in the country are going to last, aren't they?
They are. I think kind of on a financial level, you know, there's 200 billion plus of debt. A lot of that is the legacy debt from the crash, from heavy borrowing by the government to get ourselves out of that hole. I think on a personal level for a lot of investors, a lot of people's pension funds were wiped
yes.
out because of the collapse in the bank shares. And that meant people couldn't retire as they had planned. They kind of changed their life radically. So that's affected a lot of households around the country.
I think the late Gay Byrne, sadly, once told me that he was a heavy investor in Anglo.
Yeah, he had appeared at that famous EGM
yes.
Where the bank was nationalized in January 2009. He was pictured in amongst the other shareholders, and he certainly was a significant shareholder in the bank at that time. So it would have cost him dearly to see his shares in the bank wiped out. I think some of the other legacies is that regulation in this country has changed quite radically. But also, I think there's probably the one area that people are feeling most is the housing crisis. And what the crash did was it kind of wiped out a whole industry of to a large degree, domestic building industry, domestic property development. There's no doubt about that. Hubris and greed drove a lot of the decisions that those people made, and they got way in over their heads on some of the property deals that they did. But as a consequence, we don't really have a domestic construction industry funded by domestic people. The state is largely reliant on international companies to fund construction, and we're very reliant on them for providing homes and apartments for people, which is a very sad and very long-term legacy of the crash, that those people were just wiped out and many of them have never come back to the extent that's needed to solve the housing crisis in this country.
Have we learned our lesson?
I think we have. I think what happened in 2008 to 2010 shows the importance of having very tight oversight and supervision of the banks, to constantly ask questions and to constantly probe as to what the banks are doing. I think it was kind of a runaway banking sector. And I think a lot of people were swept up in the success that these people had for a very prolonged period. So the contrarians who were questioning it through the 90s and noughties, their arguments got weaker and weaker given how long this boom had gone on.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So
yes,
people who were shouting stop probably should have been listened to earlier. And certainly I think that that's changed quite radically. I think people are more open to listening to people are questioning decisions that are being made. I think we have a much more forceful regulator now, which is important. And that's certainly one of the big legacy issues from the crash. I think Sean Fitzpatrick's legacy, whatever Paul Coulson and Dermot Desmond talk about before the crash and the good things that Anglo did and the people and business that they helped out and gave a first start to, I think that's definitely going to be overshadowed by what happened in 2008 and 2010. It can't but overshadow that, given the scale of the losses and given the long-lasting effects of the economic crash. So I think Sean Fitzpatrick will be remembered for the crash more than anything that happened before it.
Okay, Simon, we're very grateful to you for joining us on the stand. Simon Carswell is the author of a brilliant book, which you can get now. I hope it's not out of print. It's a brilliant book about Ireland and, of course, about Sean Fitzpatrick and Anglo-Irish Bank. Simon is a public affairs editor of the Irish Times, and we're very grateful to him, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.